A warning. This week's show deals primarily with medical abuse. There is also some difficult language, as well as mentions of child and pet abuse and suicidal ideations. Please listen with discretion. Yeah, we missed a week.
No, we didn't.
Yes, we did.
Well, Snowmageddon happened today.
Well, we missed a week for a good reason.
We weren't here.
We weren't here. And we didn't take our stuff with us.
Despite our best efforts.
Our best efforts.
Okay.
Welcome to this week's edition of An Hour of Your Life. My name is Kim.
And my name is Steve. And I need to go on my rant.
What? Well, first of all, let's tell the people why we weren't here last week. We were finishing up our holiday. Okay, you can in a minute. We were finishing up our holidays with a visit to Florida to visit our Florida family. And so now we are officially done with the holidays mid-January. So, and we're back. Like, we're back. We should be doing an episode every week henceforth, I think.
May I rant now?
Have at it.
We got 2 to 3 inches, not 2 to 3 feet, 2 to 3 inches of snow, and everything closed. The roads weren't even really that slick. And the news, it's like Snowmageddon out there. It's watch the news. They got to tell you how to bundle your kids up. They got to take pictures of driveways where it snowed and yards of where it snowed. Our friends up in Michigan are laughing at us right now.
Spoken like a true grumpy old man.
Get off my freshly plowed driveway. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, you did hand shovel the driveway today. I was very impressed. We have a snowblower, but Steve chose to go the old-fashioned route.
Wait, there was a reason why I did that.
So that you could say, get off my hand-shoveled driveway.
No, it was a really powdery snow, and the wind was blowing, so if I used the snowblower, it would have
gone everywhere.
I would have been soaking wet by the time it was over. And so it was, like, really, really light.
Yeah. It was one of those days that I like working from home, but my office is in the basement and I don't have a window. And today was one of those days that I was kind of sad because when I went upstairs for something, like all the neighborhood kids were out playing in the snow and making snow things.
Oh my gosh.
What?
They didn't freeze to death out there today?
Oh, no.
Did their parents watch the news and bundle them properly?
Yes, they were all bundled.
Thank goodness. I wonder how they figured that out without watching the news today.
We're bundling kids up tomorrow. We have to go hang out with the grandkids.
That's fine.
They like to be outside.
I would say get off my lawn, but it's covered in 2 to 3.
Can we please start the show?
And the newscaster said something today.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm not going to say what she said on the snow, but or on the show, but I actually found it very funny.
Can we start the show now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So, wait, Gypsy no, Rose Blanchard.
I got to get to Kroger
and
get my milk and bread.
This is why sometimes I need to be the producer so I can cut your mic.
You don't know how to touch the buttons over here.
Okay. So, Gypsy Rose Blanchard, released from prison December 28th.
Wait. Are we going to talk about Gypsy Rose? Because I think the entire world has heard her story by now.
You are in fine form this evening, aren't you?
Oh, I am.
Oh, God, great. No, I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about Gypsy Rose, but it is bold of you to assume that everybody has heard her story by now because just last week, we were speaking to someone who did not know who she was. So.
My mom.
No, Jay.
She's 90.
Jay, your nephew, who is not 90, but admittedly who.
Jay, our ufologist.
Our ufologist, yes.
Ufologist, him.
But anyway, so Gypsy, we're going to talk a little bit about Gypsy, but we'll get into it. So she was born in 1991. And even as a baby, her mom, Dee Dee, started claiming that she had sleep apnea, which you have. Actually, it means that you snore, right? Isn't that what sleep apnea is?
It's a little bit more complicated than that. Snoring is a
byproduct of sleep apnea. Well, she claimed that Gypsy had sleep apnea. And by the time Gypsy was 8, her mother had claimed that she had leukemia and muscular dystrophy and that she required a feeding tube and a wheelchair. Her teeth rotted, her salivary glands were removed, and she had some kind of surgery on her larynx.
So she couldn't spit?
No, she still can't. Okay. She does not produce spit. So nothing was actually wrong with her at all, though. Over almost 20 years, Dee Dee bilked hundreds of people out of thousands of dollars and kept Gypsy completely dependent upon her.
So you're saying that all these doctors and surgeons and pediatricians let all this happen? How could this be? Sounds like some sort of malpractice suits headed their way.
Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about that later, not necessarily in Gypsy's case, but just in a general sense of the word. And this case was a little bit different because they were from New Orleans originally. And so when they moved to Missouri after Hurricane Katrina, Dee Dee was able to say, well, all of our medical records were lost in the hurricane. So her doctors just kind of had to take what she said at face value.
Okay. I know a little bit about this story because we've watched all the documents.
Yeah.
I still say the doctor could have looked at her and said,
and some doctors did. Well, okay. Well, some doctors did, but Dee Dee shut him down. Like, she was really good at what she did.
She's better than the doctors then.
We'll talk a little bit. We'll get into it.
Yeah.
So at age 19, Gypsy met a man named Nicholas Godijon online, and the two decided that the only way that they would ever be able to be together was to kill Dee Dee.
Well, I guess that's a method. You know, maybe they could have tried running away or maybe talking to some authorities. I mean, that's a pretty big step to straight to murder.
But I'm going to be on Gypsy's side on this one, because when you are in
I actually feel about
this. I know how you do, but when you are in that situation and you have been abused for an extensive period of time, you're brainwashed essentially. Like, your mind is she didn't see any other way out. And yes, there were other ways out, but when you are in that situation, I know it's easy to say, oh, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? She actually did try to leave once, and her mom found out where she was and got her and chained her to a bed for 2 weeks.
I know. Yeah.
So it's very easy to say that, but,
I'm just in a mood tonight.
I know you are. So one night Nick showed up, Gypsy let him in. He stabbed Dee Dee 17 times while she slept. I mean, obviously she woke up, and Gypsy was waiting in the next room.
Okay. You know what I'm reminded of right now?
What's that?
Lizzie Borden took an axe.
Except it wasn't Lizzie Borden. It was Lizzie Borden's boyfriend.
It reminded me
yes,
of that.
You're, okay. Yes, I can see.
Okay.
The pair was captured a few days later because Nick was not the brightest crayon in the box. And they traced his IP address like straight to, they posted something he posted on Facebook, and it's actually really creepy. That Facebook profile, Dee Dee and Gypsy's joint Facebook account, is still active, I think. And the post is still up there. It says, "That bitch is dead." And you can still go and read all of the comments that people wrote on it. You cannot comment on it anymore. Like, it's now a kind of like an in memoriam post, but you can still see all the stuff that was commented and said at the time. But they traced that post from his IP address, and
it's not hard for the authorities to
do. So they were captured a few days later. And then Dee Dee's ruse, along with Gypsy's ability to walk, because remember, she was in a wheelchair, that was all revealed.
Yeah. So wait, are you saying nobody knew she could walk before this? Didn't some of the documentaries that we watched show her in the doctor's office walking, or at least standing, and the doctor even brought Dee Dee in and said,
yeah,
what's wrong with you? She can walk.
I don't know. So those documentaries were not, I mean, that was not actually like,
is that made for Hollywood?
Some of drama? It might've been, some of it might've been, the most recent one that we watched, and the one that I actually think is the best, is the new Lifetime one, with after it was like on the eve of Gypsy's parole. They talk to her family, extended family. They talk to her now husband. And her dad, God love him, he met and he married Dee Dee when he was only 17. She was like in her mid-20s and he was only 17. So he was just young and dumb and naive and like kind of didn't know. And so he took her at her word that, you know, they got divorced or whatever. And I forget the reason, but they moved or something. Somehow he wasn't active in her life. And so he took her at her word and he knew that she could walk as a little kid and the extended family knew that she could walk as a little kid, but they kept moving. And so the family didn't see her.
So we have discussed this and I don't believe this was all planned by Gypsy as a moneymaker, but at some point I think she started seeing ways to capitalize on this. And I'm not victim blaming.
No,
you know how I feel about her conviction, because we've talked about that.
Yeah, which we didn't get into that. Because of the circumstances of the severe abuse, Gypsy signed a plea deal and she served 8 years of a 10-year sentence. Yeah. And Nick is serving life without parole. And so now she's out of prison as of December 28th.
Yeah, well, like I said, you know how I feel about her conviction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the beginning, I was kind of trying to make some fun, but I think she should have had a better lawyer.
You think that she should not have served any time,
I don't
right?
think she should have served any time yeah. in a state penitentiary. She should have been able to get help. But that's another topic that we're going to discuss another
we're
day.
We're going to get into all this stuff.
Well, not tonight, but another topic.
We'll get into it a little bit today, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
But Gypsy is not what our story is about today, is it?
It is not. She's just kind of a catalyst. Now that she's out of prison, she is quickly becoming a vocal advocate for people suffering from a disease called Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Hmm. Now, before we can get into the by proxy portion of the disease, let's first talk about just plain old Munchausen syndrome, because it's two different things.
Well, you make it sound like a common cold.
It is not at all like a common cold. The disorder itself has a pretty interesting history, and to get there, we have to go back a ways. So Munchausen syndrome is actually named after a fictional character, Baron von Munchausen, created by writer Rudolf Erich Raspe.
Name one book he wrote.
The Adventures of Baron von Munchausen.
Okay. Other than that.
I don't know, but it was a while ago. So the fictional Munchausen's exploits focus on his impossible achievements as a sportsman, a soldier, a traveler. They include things like riding on a cannonball, fighting a 40-foot crocodile, and they're all told in first person, and they're intentionally comedic and ridiculous. But this character is based on a real person. That guy's name, and this is a mouthful, Hieronymus Karl Friedrich von Munchausen. As you can probably guess, he was a German aristocrat, and he gained some minor celebrity in the retelling of his stories from various military campaigns. So he was the stuff that Erich Raspe wrote down, or Friedrich, what was his name? Rudolf Erich Raspe. The stuff that he wrote is probably just writing down the things that the actual Baron told. To give you an like kind of view of what he was like, the actual Baron von Munchausen was married at age 24. And when his wife died 46 years later, the 74-year-old Munchausen married a 17-year-old and fathered a daughter not long after. Okay.
Wait a minute. I just thought of something else.
Yeah.
Going back to Gypsy for one second.
Yeah.
When I said she saw the light of this stuff coming. Okay. So they started filming some of this stuff, the one documentary, while she was still in prison. And that is not normal procedure
right.
to allow that much airtime while someone's in
prison. And you know this because you have worked in a prison.
Yeah. And I'm just saying I think there's more to this story than what's being told. I don't think it's I don't think it's like a Lifetime created for TV drama, but
oh no, 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 yeah.
I think a lot of people saw money.
Oh, for sure. And that was one of the things that I kind of wondered too, is when she started getting, she was active on social media, like almost immediately. In fact, there is a scene in the Lifetime documentary, like the actual, where they filmed her getting out of prison. One of the very first things that she does is her husband gives her a cell phone and she pulls up Instagram. And so I hope, and I'm sure she does, but I hope that she has a team that can,
I'm sure she does,
that can manage all of this, because.
Okay. I don't know about other states, but in the state of Ohio, inmates are not allowed to have access to the internet. They can't have cell phones. They don't have Instagram account. Maybe someone was running this outside the prison her, but she wasn't doing it. Well, she wasn't in Ohio. Maybe a different state allows it.
I think she might have had internet access.
Yeah.
I don't know. She's in Missouri, I think. Mm. I think that's where she was incarcerated. So but the rules might be different. I don't know. But yeah, so she, and I don't want to begrudge her that, because you really, if she wrote a book that came out on December or January 10th, I have not read it yet. I'm on the wait list for it. But I, if you have to think about, she never got any education. Like, she graduated in prison from high school. So she has no marketable skills. So right. This is her identity. Like, this is how she can make money.
Well, let's get back to the, let's get back to the Baron.
Okay. So, the real Munchausen hated the fake Munchausen so much that he actually sued the publisher and became a recluse. Like, he went from high society to he never left the house.
Kind of like Howard Hughes.
Lot, actually, which we should do a show on Howard Hughes sometime. So anyway, if you didn't know anything at all about Munchausen syndrome, you probably think that it has something to do with delusions of grandeur or over the top claims, but that's not entirely accurate.
Accurate or inaccurate?
It is not accurate. The fact that delusions of grandeur or over the top claims, partially right, not completely. Munchausen syndrome is also, it's not called that anymore. Now it's called factitious disorder imposed on self. And the clinical definition is a psychological condition wherein a person pretends to be ill or deliberately produces symptoms of an illness in themselves.
Isn't that hypochondria?
Hypochondria?
Hypochondria, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, when I first started researching, that was my question too. Like, what's the difference? They sound like the same thing, but there is one substantial and pretty dark difference.
Dark?
Yeah. Mm. Hypochondriacs may think that they have things wrong with them, but Munchausen's patients know they don't have anything wrong with them, and they create the things that are wrong.
Hmm. Okay. I can understand. I can see the difference.
Yeah.
There.
So they know, the Munchausen's patients know, and I'm going to call it here, Munchausen's for now. They know that without their intervention, they're perfectly healthy. So they intentionally deceive family, friends, and healthcare providers. And hypochondria is more of like an anxiety disorder, whereas Munchausen's is arguably much more serious.
I think hypochondriacs are, I think that's a pretty serious problem too, because think about it. They tie up a doctor's pretty precious time that the doctor could be working on patients with real problems. And I wonder how much hypochondriacs cost the insurance industry, which obviously is passed on to all of us through higher premiums.
Yeah.
So I wondered that, so I looked it up.
Okay.
Some estimates say that hypochondriacs cost the insurance industry $20 billion a year. That's a lot of money.
It is. I believe it. And I'm not saying that hypochondria is not serious, but I think, at least in my opinion, Munchausen's is much more nefarious because it's so intentional. Hypochondria is not really intentional. Like, they can't help it. Munchausen's, they are deliberately making things
happen. That would make a law against that.
There's not, actually. We'll get into that a little bit too, I think. Yeah.
Ought to make one.
Okay. So although Munchausen's is pretty uncommon, according to a national hospital discharge survey, 7 cases per 100,000. So less than 1% of patients in the clinical setting. What's not uncommon is for Munchausen's patients to have additional and sometimes underlying disorders. So common comorbid conditions.
You're using words.
Sorry. Comorbid means they also have this.
Okay.
And it contributes to their Munchausen's. Borderline personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, both of which are attention-seeking disorders. So they dovetail real nicely with Munchausen's. In fact, most Munchausen patients don't seem to be interested in personal gain, like money or drugs. They just want the attention. And the most common patient is an unmarried female in the healthcare community, which to me makes sense.
Please tell me how so.
If you're spending all day reading patient charts, then you learn pretty quickly what the symptoms are for all kinds of stuff. So if you're in the healthcare industry, you know kind of what doctors look for. And if you're unmarried or you don't have a partner, I would think it gets pretty lonely. And so you turn wherever you can for attention.
Maybe they should get a puppy, or maybe we should start a website, like something maybe like datadoctor.com.
I think that's a terrible idea.
Yeah. Well, then they wouldn't be doing...
Then they would just be the doctors. They would still be the doctor's problem, just a different kind of problem. So how do they do it? Their complaints are somatic, which means the translation for somatic means it feels wrong. So it might not always show up on tests. So like the most common complaints for Munchausen's are chest pain, abdominal pain, vomiting and or diarrhea,
which you can fake that stuff.
Yeah. Anemia, hypoglycemia, infection, seizures, weakness, headaches, vision loss, skin wounds, joint pain. So
skin wounds, I mean, you're going to see those.
Yeah. So, but some of them are pretty hard to prove. Like
my back hurts.
Right. I prove it. You can't, right? You can't prove pain. You can't prove weakness. You can't prove headaches. And even more minor issues like anemia or hypoglycemia, both of which I suffer from. And when I say suffer,
I suffer from,
I mean that like with anemia, I get really tired and I bruise easily. And hypoglycemia, I get really lightheaded and weird feeling if I go for too long without eating. That's it.
Prove it.
That's it. But I mean,
prove it.
You've seen me when I'm having like a hypoglycemic issue. I've seen you issue.
After you've been reading charts and things like that. So
no, you've
prove it.
But my point is, it's not really life altering stuff. It's super easy to fix. Either I should be taking iron supplements.
Or you cook more in cast iron.
I don't take iron supplements. If I notice that I'm starting to bruise a lot, I will say, hey, Steve, we need to break out the cast iron. And then if I'm having an issue with hypoglycemia and my blood sugar drops, I just eat something like high sugar and I feel better pretty soon. So it's not like it's stuff that's hard to fix. So it's certainly not stuff that you should be getting like your kidney removed for hypoglycemia or something. You know what I mean? So you can kind of see how Munchausen's works within the healthcare system. So I thought it would be kind of fun to track a patient. I work in the healthcare system. I do some of this stuff for a living.
So just remember HIPAA.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to talk about any specific patient, but I'll be our fictitious patient. So I present to my primary care doctor complaining that my lower back hurts all the time. I'm not sure when it started, but it seems to be getting worse. So the doctor is going to do an X-ray. He doesn't find anything wrong. But I'm in pain and it's starting to interfere with my daily life. And it's really hard to manage steps sometimes because more than once I've bent over and the stabbing pain made me catch my breath. Like it's really bad. So the doctor is going to send me to 6 to 8 weeks of physical therapy at least.
That's like a medieval torture chamber.
So I go to the 6 for the 8 weeks. I do all the exercises at therapy and I say that I'm doing them at home.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't help. In fact, it kind of feels like the therapy made it worse.
No doubt.
So my doctor orders a CT scan. Maybe the x-ray was just inconclusive. Well, the CT scan comes back unremarkable. But at this point, I'm in tears.
You can fake some big old crocodile tears.
I can. So,
like when the cop pulls you over.
Oh, yeah. So the pain just continues to get worse. Obviously, something is wrong, doctor. Why don't you believe me? Like, nothing is helping. Not heat, not ice, not physical therapy, not being still, not anti-inflammatories. It hurts. Please, can't we just do something?
Poor Kim.
Well, yes, we can do something. We can try an injection of a more powerful steroidal anti-inflammatory directly into the spinal canal.
Kind of like what Rupert got.
Yeah. Yep. It's an injection directly into the spinal canal. And so we do that. We try it once or twice. It's just not helping. And by now, I can't handle stairs anymore.
You work in the basement, you just said.
I do. So I have to go down the stairs into the basement.
And we live in a ranch.
But I have to go.
So I don't want
to
hear this.
I have to go down the stairs into the basement. It's interfering with my work because I can't get down the stairs to my office. So I get a cane and I am completely reliant upon this cane that I bought. My doctor just can't figure out what's wrong. So he sends me to an ortho specialist and the ortho specialist looks at everything that I've had done. They order an MRI. The MRI also comes back unremarkable, but my sob story cycle starts all over again with this new doctor. We've tried everything. It still hurts. It's getting worse instead of better. Next thing you know, we have an invasive spinal surgery scheduled, and inevitably the surgery is going to exacerbate another part of my body and on and on and on and on and on.
Okay, so.
By the way, I intentionally chose this because that is the area in which I primarily work is orthopedics. So I know that this is the track that you would go down if so you wanted to do this.
This sounds to me like a lot of work and time. See, now we're adding lost productivity at work. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could keep my story straight.
Well, that's
there's so much if you start bouncing between doctors.
And sometimes that's how people get caught. But you have to remember, like, a lot of times you settle on one story and you just tell that story to every doctor. Well, and it's just not getting better.
Well.
It can be really easy to blame the physicians, but when you look at a case in this light, maybe it's a little bit easier to understand.
Look,
I don't mean to cut you off. Also, the amount of time that is allotted for each of these appointments with your doctor, honestly, you maybe get 15 minutes of FaceTime with the doctor.
And it's 15 minutes the doctor could have had with someone else. Look, I would think right now with medical records becoming more digitized, it seems like doctors would be able to recognize this just a little bit easier. But I guess these people are taking up their time so they don't have time to scrutinize too deeply what they're doing. Because like you said, they're only getting 15 minutes.
I can answer that too.
I bet you can.
I can because, again, this is my line of work. Part of the reason why I am so interested in this. Yes. All of the medical records are digitized, but not every hospital or doctor uses the same electronic health record. It's called EMR or EHR. So like some hospitals might use something called Epic. Another hospital might use something called Citrix. So, and if you have Epic, you can't see the files from the Citrix. So you would think, but it's not that simple. So, and on top of that, I'm a medical mystery. They can't figure out what's wrong with me. And doctors don't like mysteries. By nature, they are problem solvers. So if you have a doctor that can't solve the problem, they're either going to call you out and say there's nothing wrong, in which case then you just go and get a second opinion.
My bedside manner would be terrible because that's what I would do.
Well, then I would just go get a second opinion.
You're out of my hair.
That's true. Or that doctor is going to send you to a specialist who will eventually provide some kind of treatment. And so it can be really hard to diagnose Munchausen's because there's several other disorders that are pretty similar.
Yeah. So there's money being made by, yeah, of course I'll operate on your back. Yeah. But wait, you know what? This seems to be like it would be a perfect thing for AI to recognize. AI should be able to read medical records and recognize these telltale signs of hypochondria, or at least shoot up a star cluster and say, hey, doc, take a closer look at this patient because my highly in-tune algorithms are seeing something that is a little bit fishy in Denmark on this. And you know, it could do that.
Yes, that actually would not surprise me if that is one of the things that is on down the line in the development of the healthcare field.
Every good idea I've ever had.
Well, it's not there yet, as far as I know.
I hereby patent this idea.
I pretty recently wrote an article for a healthcare magazine that they say they want me to write some more. That might be a good article topic.
That would
I'll have to
be,
look into that.
Yeah, it's patented. Kay. You heard it.
Okay.
Right here.
So we already mentioned hypochondria, but there's also something called malingering.
Oh, wait a minute. Do you know that malingering is a punishable crime in the military, in the Uniform Code of Military Justice?
I did not know that.
Oh, it is. It's Article 83 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
You just know off the top of your head it's 83?
Yeah, you have to learn all that stuff. I did have to Google here to get the right words, but you get used to all the different articles and stuff like that. So when a service member knew of an assignment for the performance of work and that the accused feigned illness, physical disablement, mental lapse, mental derangement, or intentionally inflicted injury upon themselves to avoid work or duty.
That's malingering.
That is malingering. You know, back in, you always heard stories, soldiers would like shoot themselves in the foot mm-hmm. to get out of going to war and stuff like
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what the punishment is?
I do not. I'm sure you're going to tell me though.
Dishonorable discharge, forfeiture of all pay and allowances, and confinement for 1 year.
Wow.
It would just be so much easier just to go and do your job.
Yeah. So forfeiture of all pay, does that mean you have to pay it back? Or like no. You just don't get any more?
No, it's like they can put you in prison at Leavenworth for
a year.
Well, Leavenworth doesn't take them for a year, but
oh.
they can put you in military prison for a year and you don't get any pay for it. They'll feed you.
Wow. So malingering is kind of similar, except that malingering, the goal is some sort of personal gain. So like you don't have to go to war. Or in our example, at some point, probably like if I was doing malingering instead of Munchausen's.
Do you do malingering or you malinger?
You malinger, yeah. I guess. So if at some point, if I malingered.
You know, I don't have a master's degree in English. I'm just sitting here.
So in our example, at some point, probably after the x-rays or a few failed PT visits, I'd ask for a heavier pain medication. And now that I have the narcotic prescription that I wanted, wouldn't you know it, that worked. So let's just keep doing that. And I'm now hooked on narcotics and have access to drugs to either take or sell. That's malingering. Mm. That's the difference. So so when you talk about these somatic disorders.
In the Army, they just send you to jail.
Yeah. Okay. So when you talk about these somatic disorders, you might also hear the term conversion disorder, which, as I understand it, is pretty much the same thing as hypochondria. So remember that in that instance, even though there may be nothing wrong with the patient, they genuinely believe that there is. In Munchausen's, they know there's nothing wrong. They're intentionally fabricating their symptoms. So if you are ever happen to be doing some more research and educating yourself and you hear conversion disorder, think hypochondria. Okay, so now that we know what Munchausen's is, let's get into the by proxy, which just means that a caregiver doesn't want to make themselves sick, so they make the person or even their pet under their care sick instead.
Rupert is actually sick.
He really is sick. We have the things to prove it.
But look, this is pretty disturbing and it's disgusting, but I'm sure you're going to get into all that.
Oh, I have a lot.
Like, and Gypsy's a perfect example of how this is disgusting.
Not
from her part, but
Dee Dee. She is a very extreme example.
They whack Dee Dee.
Yeah. So same outcome with Munchausen by proxy, but oh man, there's so many more possibilities. I should clarify that technically, again, it's not called Munchausen syndrome by proxy anymore. It's called so if Munchausen's is factitious disorder imposed on self, what do you think Munchausen by proxy is?
You tell me.
Factitious disorder imposed upon another.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Or FDIA, which is what I'm going to be using for the remainder of the time because it's a lot shorter, but just know it's the same thing as Munchausen by proxy.
I could have looked smart and just looked at your notes.
You could have. Yeah. So the statistics for FDIA are a lot lower even than Munchausen's. They're reported at somewhere between 1 and 28 million per children. So pretty rare. But a lot of experts think that it's vastly underreported. And in an era of political correctness in the face of litigation, you can understand why. This is a really serious accusation to make. And if the parent pushes back, which they will, then you could face all kinds of problems.
That's a shame, but what a dichotomy. You try to protect a child and you get sued for doing what is best for the kid.
There's actually a really good documentary about this. I forget what streaming platform it's on, but it's called Take Care of Maya. And that's what it is. Essentially, it's this girl, Maya, who the hospital thought that she was being abused by her mom, that her mom had Munchausen's by proxy. So they basically kept Maya in the hospital and would not let her go home, even though she really was sick. So if you want to check out kind of the other flip side of things, then that's a good documentary to watch. Yeah. So a few of the other stats, some of which we'll probably get into a little later. FDIA wasn't categorized as a mental disorder by the American Psychiatric Association until 2013, although something similar has either been proposed or used since 1977. Initially, it only included the infliction of harmful medical care and was first described all the way back in 1951 by a British endocrinologist and hematologist named Richard Asher. And I'm not sure why they didn't name it after him, but he's probably glad they didn't. The first few cases came to be called Munchausen's by proxy. That was in 1977. And that was when a pediatrician named Roy Meadow, who did have the disorder named after him for a while, they were pretty extreme. And so a couple of the cases mentioned by other doctors around the time talked about something called psychosocial dwarfism, which is essentially when a person is so badly abused or mistreated that they not only stop developing mentally, but they also stop growing physically. So, like, think feral kids.
We know a few of them.
No, like actual feral kids.
No, we know a few of them.
One of the cases that Meadows wrote about involved a mother who had poisoned her toddler with excessive amounts of salt. So, but stick a pin in Roy Meadows because we're going to come back to him later. Some other statistics that I thought were interesting were that FDIA is more common in women who have difficult pregnancies or who have Munchausen's themselves. In over 90% of cases, the abuser is a female guardian or caregiver, and there doesn't really seem to be a difference between male and female victims. But in the few cases where the abuser is a man, the victim is more than 3 times likely to be male. And I said we'd come back to Roy Meadows.
Well, can I pull that pin out of him now? I mean, this is starting to sound like a voodoo doll.
Yes. So one of the things I want to talk about is a study he published in 1998, which is one of the few done on fathers and is really still the gold standard on male FDIA studies. So Meadows followed 15 families for 10 years. Some of the findings: in 9 out of the 15 cases, the child was presented at the ER with symptoms of seizing, not breathing, turning blue, or being unconscious. Usually, it was the father who found them and then heroically administered CPR. 4 of the fathers were later caught smothering their child. Either somebody walked in on them in the hospital or they were caught on camera.
I have a really good idea for them.
13 out of the 15 fathers were living with their partner, and the median length of that partnership was 16 months. All of the mothers were one or two years younger than the fathers. And in 8 of the cases, they were the primary caregivers, the mothers were. One of the mothers had learning disabilities of her own, and the father was, quote unquote, treating both her and their child. So he was abusing both of them medically. All of the fathers, all 15 of them, were of average or above average intelligence, but only one of the 15 was able to maintain long-term employment, interestingly, in the military.
Article 83.
There you go. 5 of the 15 were on disabilities. 6 had been seen previously by psychiatrists who had noted things like aggressive personality, hysterical amnesia, neurotic panic attacks, and personality disorder with schizoid features. There weren't any specific numbers given, but Meadows said that it was, quote, common for the men to have been treated excessively before their child was sick, then rarely treated during that period, and then treated excessively again after the child was well, or in 3 of the cases, after the child had died. In 4 of the homes, there had been unusual fires, none of which were household accidents. All were blamed on like a neighbor or a burglar or something. Also in 4 of the homes, pets died under unusual circumstances. And in at least one of the homes, the dog seemed to have been practiced for the kid because he was seen at the vet for all kinds of random stuff repeatedly. Lots of cases of embellishments, like saying that he wrote a screenplay and was working with Steven Spielberg, or that he had saved a girl from gang rape, or in one case, there was a father who had caused so much harm to his own leg that it needed to be amputated.
Now, did you say that this is not a mental disorder?
No, it is a mental disorder, but it was not called Munchausen's until, or Munchausen by proxy until the 70s.
Then that's why Gypsy shouldn't have gone to jail.
There you go. So although it's rare, the cases by men do happen. And interestingly, they seem to face more and harsher criminal punishments than mothers who have FDIA.
Now, that's just not fair.
It's not.
So why do you think that is?
I don't know, but I would guess that it is because of historically women are hysterical and weak-minded and so on and so forth. And the men are supposed to be strong and be able to control their impulses and blah, 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 would be my guess. Subconscious or not. So anyway, Roy Meadows was actually knighted for his work.
Oh, I'm knighty.
Yeah, but later he fell from grace when a bunch of the criminal cases in which he testified as an expert witness were overturned.
Ooh,
yeah.
Thinking Prince Andrew. Did I say that?
You did. So we commonly think of FDIA cases as being a parent who perpetrates the abuse, but that's not always the case. So if you don't like doctors, maybe it's best to just go ahead and say goodbye now. Hope you enjoyed the show. See you next week. For the rest of us, let's talk about a nurse named Beverly, I think it's pronounced Aylett. She was one of 4 children. Growing up, she always seemed to have something wrong with her. She'd wear bandages, she'd wear casts, but she wouldn't allow anyone to see her actual injuries. And then later in school, she'd become overweight. She was hostile. She was aggressive towards others. At one point, she had her perfectly good appendix removed. And she took a really long time to heal because she kept interfering with the surgical scar.
So what kind of quack doctor would remove a perfectly good appendix? I'm seriously, it's pretty easy to determine if an appendix is healthy or it needs to be removed. I have 2 words on this one. Insurance job.
I have 2 words too. She's British. Oh, sorry, Britain. Okay, anyway.
We have a lot of listeners over there, so she apologizes.
And
to the state of Georgia. But honestly, I about said something about Missouri this time.
Okay, so as an adult, she went to nursing school, of course, but she was chronically absent. She kept failing her exams. So she was accepted, though, in a temporary capacity at a chronically understaffed hospital, where they put her to work in the children's ward. And when she started there, this is how bad the staffing was. There were only two trained nurses on day shift and one at night. So you can see how desperate this hospital was. On February 21st, 1991, 7-month-old Liam Taylor was admitted with a chest infection. Aylett went out of her way to assure his parents that he was in good hands. They should go home, get some rest. And when they came back, they found out that he had had a respiratory emergency, but he'd recovered. Nurse Aylett was taking extra shifts to stay with him. Just before midnight, he had another emergency, but the staff on duty thought he'd come through it okay. However, when Aylett was left alone with him, Liam's condition got a lot worse. And weirdly, his emergency monitors never went off. And after suffering cardiac arrest, the baby died.
Look, there were plenty of signs. See something, say something. Medicine is not something that you should just accept coincidences out of. There are plenty of anomalies here that should have been checked out.
But keep in mind, this is just the first one. So there, this one, you can kind of be like, oh.
Yeah, no, with all that stuff going on, someone should have said something's not right here.
Well, just 2 weeks later, an 11-year-old came in suffering an epileptic episode. Aylett took over that boy's care, and just like Liam, the boy died after the emergency resuscitation team had been summoned. An autopsy was done, but no definitive cause of death was found. Literally 3 days later, another kid went into cardiac arrest in the very same bed that Liam had.
And, okay, so I'll give you a little bit of credit.
Yeah.
One time. Okay, it just happened.
Yeah.
But by this time, nobody is getting suspicious or adding 2 plus 2 on this.
And that's what I thought too, but you have to remember how really understaffed this
Don't
hospital
care.
Was. I know it's
How
not
many
an
dead
excuse.
Kids we got now?
I know. Not an excuse, but
not,
it
not
is.
Not accepting this one.
But it's a reason. Not an excuse, but it's a reason. So that girl that went into cardiac arrest, she had been doing well up to that point. So she was transferred to another hospital. And this is where they start to be like, doctors in that hospital found a weird puncture hole in her armpit and an air bubble near that site. So that kind of was the first pink flag. I wouldn't say it's really a red flag at this point, but there's so many more. 25 episodes, in fact, between 13 patients.
25.
4 of those patients died.
Mm.
And all of this happened between February 21st and April 22nd, 1991. So 2 months. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. There's some real geniuses working at this place.
Yeah.
Okay.
So once the hospital started getting suspicious, they started looking for patterns. Sure enough, they found that unusually high doses of insulin had been present in most of the cases, or a lot of them anyway. Interestingly, Aylett had reported the key to the insulin box missing. That's weird. There were also several nursing logs that went missing. Now, so by July, police felt that they'd had enough evidence to charge her, but they didn't until November. I'm not sure why. Maybe they were still ironing out some stuff to make sure the charges stuck. But she refused to confess. She was charged with 4 cases of murder, 11 cases of attempted murder, and 11 counts of causing grievous bodily harm. She didn't actually go to trial until February of 1993, so 2 years after she started her stuff, because she kept experiencing illnesses, which, by the way, caused her to lose 70 pounds.
Lock her up. Lock her up.
Her trial lasted 2 months, get this, of which she only attended 16 days because, again, illnesses.
That poor thing.
Mm-hmm. She was convicted and given 13 life sentences, but not in a prison. Instead, Beverly Aylett was sent to Rampton Secure Hospital, which is more like a mental health facility.
It's a prison.
So Liam Taylor's dad, Liam Taylor was the very first little seven-month-old boy, among others, say that it's way too nice of a place, and he likens it more to a resort than a prison. To give you kind of an idea of what he's talking about, there are 1,400 staff for 400 patients, and it costs taxpayers $3,000 per week per inmate.
I take back my comment.
about.
It's a prison. I kind of whispered her. Okay, look, I'm not saying a word. We talked about doing a show on mental health treatment and facilities one day. Mm-hmm. There are intentional things that happen to get our mental health treatment to where it is today. And I'm talking the United States. Mm-hmm. Now, would you believe that politics are involved?
No, no way. Mm. We have talked about doing a show about this, and I really would like to at some point because it is really interesting. But in the United States, we actually have our own infamous Munchausen's nurse. His name is Charles Cullen. He had a really rough life as a kid, like really rough. He was the youngest of eight. His dad died when he was only 7 months old. Charles was bullied constantly by his schoolmates. He tried to commit suicide for the first time when he was only nine. When he was 17, his mom was killed in a car accident, which absolutely devastated him. Especially, and this is kind of messed up, I think, the hospital, he was especially devastated because the hospital cremated her before they even told him she was dead. That's
destroying the evidence.
I can't even imagine. So after high school, Cullen passed the psych test to be a naval submariner, which I thought was interesting, but he didn't fit in there either. Once his leading petty officer found him sitting at the missile controls wearing surgical gloves, a mask, and scrubs instead of his regular uniform.
Okay. The military does have some pretty tight control on things like people that work with missiles and nukes.
Yeah.
In the Army, we call it the personnel reliability program. All your personnel records, your medical records, they were stored separate and under lock and key. And if you had to go under general anesthesia for something, there were precautions that had to happen in case you talked while you were out. Okay, all this. And just like you were talking about, strange behavior was noticed and reported and acted upon in the military.
Well, and this was acted upon. So I do want to press the fact that he passed his psych eval. So he, on paper, was fine.
Quack.
He was reprimanded and disciplined for this being out of uniform thing.
This reminds me of one kid that you used to watch that would walk. You know who I'm talking about. Don't mention names, but you know who I'm talking about.
The blonde girl?
Yeah. Walk around with gloves on her
hand. Yes. Okay. So anyway, Cullen was committed to the Naval Psych Ward a couple times before he was medically discharged.
He can't even talk now without laughing because now you're thinking about it.
I know. So what do you do after the Navy kicks you out for being nuts? You go to nursing school, of course. So he graduated in 1986 and he started working in a burn unit. Somebody liked him because he got married in 1987. He had two daughters. But his wife started getting really worried because he was exhibiting unusual behavior and he was abusing the family dogs. Red flag, red flag, red flag. The wife accused Cullen of things like spiking people's drinks with lighter fluid, setting fire to his daughter's books, and leaving the kids with a babysitter for a week. Which, honestly, who hasn't thought about that once or twice? But so now we have a documented pattern of behavior. In 1988, he committed his first murder when he administered a lethal overdose of medication to a patient. He was alleged to have killed dozens of patients at that hospital. This is the burn unit hospital between 1988 and 1992, often with insulin overdoses. Sound familiar?
Yep.
He later took a job at a New Jersey hospital where he murdered three elderly women. His final victim there said that a sneaky male nurse. Oh. What?
You sneaky. Okay, go ahead.
A sneaky male nurse had injected her.
That is a reference to
Trailer Park Boys.
Trailer Park Boys. Bubbles.
He had injected her as she slept. However, family members and healthcare providers of the hospital dismissed her comments as unfounded. She's old. What does she know? So, in 1993, he said that he wanted to quit nursing, but he couldn't afford to, so he just kept killing people.
See something, say something.
Cullen took 2 months off from work. He was treated for depression in two psychiatric facilities. He attempted suicide twice more by the end of the year. and was still working as a nurse. That September, a 91-year-old cancer patient at Warren Hospital reported that Cullen, who was not her assigned nurse, had come into her room and injected her with a needle. She died the next day. Her son protested that her death was not natural. The hospital administered a lie detector test to Cullen and several other nurses, which he passed. So he's good at this deception thing.
There's ways to get around lie detectors.
Yeah.
You have to be very, very good at it. And he could have administered himself certain drugs to do this.
Absolutely. So over the next 4 years, Cullen worked at two other hospitals, was responsible for the intentional deaths of at least 8 patients, one of which was blamed on another nurse. Even with his history of mental...
She did it.
I know, right? Even with his history of mental instability and the number of deaths during his employment at various hospitals, Cullen continued to find work because of a national nurse shortage. Additionally, there was no reporting mechanism yet that existed to identify nurses with mental health or employment problems. Liability concerns, which we kind of talked about earlier, made hospitals unwilling to take significant action against him. All told, it's thought that Cullen killed over 40 patients during his 16-year-long career. He is serving 11 consecutive sentences in a prison. He will be eligible for parole in 2403 when he is 443 years old.
I wonder what he'll do when he gets out.
I don't know. So why did he do it? Well, Cullen said that he had overdosed patients to spare them from being seen going into cardiac or respiratory arrest and being listed as a code blue emergency.
So he's a humanitarian.
Yep. He told detectives that he could not bear to witness or hear about attempts at saving a victim's life. Cullen also stated that he gave patients overdoses so that he could end their suffering.
It sounds like
Dr. Death, Jack of Orkian.
No, and it sounds like a God complex.
Could be.
Yeah.
He wanted to prevent hospital personnel from dehumanizing them.
This guy's amazing.
He actually is the subject of a movie. I don't remember what it's called, but it's out there. If you just look up Charles Cullen, I'm sure you'll find the movie about him. Something about like Bad Nurse or something like that.
Well, that's the understatement of the year. So look, what good are background checks and records good for if nobody pays any attention to them? This kind of reminds me of, you know, the thing now, red flag laws. Mm-hmm. How many mass shooters warning signs were ignored? Again, this sounds like something that AI could be of a benefit to.
I would agree with you. Yeah, there is definitely potential there. So clearly Munchausen's and Munchausen's by proxy are hard to catch, but there are signs and it's starting to be noticed more often. So what to look for?
Dang it. They're already using my AI.
Well, no, it's just their document. They have better documentation now. What to look for? The child or dependent person has a history of many hospitalizations. Often there's also a strange set of symptoms. The child or dependent person's symptoms are generally being reported by the mother or other caretaker and not being witnessed by hospital staff. The child or dependent person's condition and symptoms are not matching the results of the diagnostic test. So if you go in for an MRI of your arm and you are complaining of a headache, like that's not going to, it doesn't, you know. The child or dependent person's condition improves in the hospital, but the symptoms start recurring once they go home. That's a big one. Blood in the lab samples. This is also a big one. Blood in the lab samples does not match the blood of the child or the dependent person.
Bingo.
That's a big one. Sometimes the person with FDIA will put their own blood in there or some, you know, tamper with the blood. The child or dependent person possibly has signs of chemicals in the blood, the stool, or the urine. So there isn't a cure for FDIA. Nor for Munchausen's. And if it is identified, hopefully before the patient dies, Treatment usually involves social services, law enforcement, and heavy therapy. You mentioned, you know, going back to Gypsy Rose, child services did come to her house, but child services is overworked. And it's not hard to figure out the right things to say to make them go away. So technically, FDIA is not a crime in itself, but it is considered a form of child abuse. So that's the crime.
Yeah, duh.
It is considered, if it's considered a felony. Now, it's not always. Sometimes it's just a misdemeanor. But if it is considered a felony, the maximum sentence is 6 years in prison.
We need to work on that one.
Maximum.
Write your congressman.
We started all of this talking about Gypsy Rose Blanchard. One of the things that makes her case so unique, she is the only person who suffered from FDIA who is known to have killed their abuser.
That we know of.
Yes, the only known person who killed their abuser.
Oh, no, I guess that's the key word. Mm-hmm. All right.
That's not to say that other people haven't, but she's okay. The only one they know of.
So this is pretty interesting right mm-hmm. here. And we've talked about some pretty heavy topics with this one.
Yes.
So it's, I know.
How do you leave this? I know. Yeah, it's a hard one.
How do you leave this? So,
yeah.
So Kim, how do you get a hold of us?
You can find us on a lot of the socials. We have a Threads account. We have a new TikTok account where I'm posting a minute of your life every week. This week, I talk about a very specific family where the mom had FDIA. We have an Instagram account. We have a website, anhouroofyourlife.com, and you can find links to all of those other things, except the TikTok. I need to link that. You can find links to all those other things on the website. You can also find a contact us form on the website, or you can write to us at alosthour@gmail.com. On the socials, it's An Hour of Your Life for everything.
Please write us, because we really, really like to get the comments from people.
We love it.
And some people we end up talking to, corresponding. Honestly, back and forth.
Yeah, and
we have Facebook friends now that...
Well, we have real friends, Sarah Koshel, who we had on for her Dayton books.
I'm talking about people who wrote us.
Yeah, well, that's how we found Sarah. She found us through TikTok, and now Sarah is one of my dear friends, and she's coming back. She wrote another book, so we're going to have her back on again.
That's great. Sarah's pleasant to have around.
She's awesome. But speaking of likes, I know you hear this on all the podcasts, but like our podcast, please, and give us good reviews.
And
tell your friends.
Yeah. This is a case where see something, say something doesn't apply. Just say something to your friends. Okay. Tell them like, hey,
I just
listened to the best podcast ever. You should check out Stephen Kim's An Hour of Your Life.
Yeah.
It's really, you'll learn stuff. You'll be the trivia champion.
Or if you didn't like the show, still tell your friends. You'd be like, you would not believe this terrible podcast. You have to listen to how bad this is.
It's a train wreck.
It's a train wreck. Hopefully that's not how you feel though.
All right. I'm getting hungry.
Yeah. I still got some pizza night.
I still got to put some stuff up on the web and stuff like that. But yeah. I'm going to order the pizza.
Yes.
And then the stuff is going up there. So. From our studio in Sugar Creek Township.
Thanks for spending an hour of your life with us.
I love that song.
Sources this week include biography.com, Charlie Health, the National Library of Medicine, Wikipedia, the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine, and the Cleveland Clinic.